All right, welcome everyone to the latest edition of the ABCs of Green Politics. And today we're on Q is for Queer Ecology. So I'm your co-host Linda Sullivan, and my other co-host is John Barry. So we have Owana and Niamh with us today to talk about queer ecology. Niamh is an artist and a poet, and her art is collaborative and social art. And Owana is a writer and researcher. So thanks both for being with us. Can I ask is maybe just introduce yourselves a wee bit more about, well, where you're based and what you do yourselves. So Niamh, do you want to start?
Sure. Thanks so much for having me on. My name is Niamh Byrne. I am an artist and a poet, as you said, from North Kildare originally, but I have been living for over a decade now in Dublin 8, living and working, trying to do both at the same time. So yeah, I have a collaborative arts practice, collaborative arts and social arts. My practice usually takes the form of spoken word, performance art, participatory performance gatherings, broadcast as well more recently. So as an artist, I draw deeply from queering of my cultural heritage. So I draw deeply from folklore, from vernacular spiritualities, quarter day traditions, mythologies. The work I try to make is quite anti-nationalist in its kind of positioning. And as far as kind of, I've always had an interest in land, relation to land, relate human and non-human life forms and worlds. So yeah, that's kind of a very broad sweeping overview. I could go on, but I won't.
Great, thanks. And Owana?
Yeah, thanks also for having me. So I'm currently based in France, in the eastern part of France on the border of Germany. But I was born in Romania and I grew up there and also in the United States. And then most of my adult life have been very interested in Irish poetry. And so I've spent a lot of time in school and I've been reading and writing about poetry and also writing poetry, but I've been specifically interested in Irish poetry. And more recently, I've also been studying theology in the last 10 years and thinking about contemporary Irish poetry and theology and thinking about how these two disciplines speak to each other, specifically in Ireland. And also about how having literacy around them might be helpful to meeting social challenges. And I do think that for me, in some ways, Ireland, my relationship to Ireland, which has been longstanding and mysterious, I think has some connection to my relationship with the place where I was born. In Romania, there are a lot of very kind of similar cultural wounds, historical wounds, and similar history of invasions and disconnection from land. So the social challenges that I feel really committed to in my work and in my research have to do with mental health, and specifically around grief and how often unprocessed grief, whether individual, collective, impacts relationships and institutions. From small institutions such as families, all the way to government. And I identify as queer, and that identification has informed my research and my practice and kind of the way I live my life. I really like bell hooks' way of thinking about queerness, and she called it queer not as being about who you're having sex with, although that can be a dimension of it, but queer as being about the self that is at odds with everything around it and has to invent and create and find a place to seek and to thrive and to live. And I really love that, the broadness, but also practical aspect of that definition. So that's kind of where I situate myself.
Yeah. And so in terms of queer ecology, like that term, I wasn't really familiar with that term until recently. So I'm going to read out a paragraph by Alex Johnson, recommended by yourself, Owana, which is a really good kind of introduction. And then just going to ask you to expand on it or what queer ecology means for you, really. So he says, I don't mean to insist that there is an ecological mandate for being gay. My interest in queering ecology lies in enabling humans to imagine an infinite number of possible natures. The living world exhibits monogamy, but it also exhibits orgies, gender transformation, and cloning. What then is natural? All of it? None of it? Instead of using the more than human world as justification for or against certain behavior and characteristics, let's use the more than human world as a humbling indication of the capacity and diversity of all life on Earth. So would Niamh, do you want to add your understanding of queer ecology and maybe like how you first came to the concept?
So actually, I cannot pinpoint the time in which I first came across this. It could have been when researching, you know, or looking into writing around like decolonization. It could have been before that. But yeah, for me, it was kind of an illuminating moment. So for me, queer ecology is a challenge. Its existence in the lexicon is a pushback against the flattening narratives of human exceptionalism and kind of what I think of as like colonial order, you know, that way there was like, this is humanity, these are the borders of the town, this is the borders of the home, the borders of the family, and you have to, you know, and this kind of insistence on rising that which is considered the natural world or the non-human world is a lower order. So all of that heavy oppressive thinking that we have been living in, I think there's a challenge for us to pull ourselves out of. So as a poet, I tend to think esoterically around the power of words. So to add a bit of mysticism to all of that, for me, as a phrase, queer ecology, it's like a tool of illumination. So I'm speaking from the cultural position of an Irish person with a severed and forgotten connection to land, maybe severed, not so forgotten, but definitely severed. So introduction to queer ecology to me is like a lifting of the veil. And on the other side is this expanse of life forms that is wild, weird, and deeply and intimately familiar. So I have always had an interest in non-human worlds. Since I was a child, I was always drawn to nature and non-human beings. I was pretty privileged. One of my parents, was a horticulturist. So in many ways I cannot tell you really when it was that it all really started for me. I do remember though at a young age being brought up Roman Catholic, there was a disconnect for me between the happiness I felt and the kind of being at home, not separated from humanity. Like, I don't have an interest in being separated from humans, but more that being a human in natural ecologies, being in the wild or amongst nature, how, yeah, at home that feels and how connected that feels. Yeah, so I don't consider queer ecology to be a philosophy or even like ideology, because for me it is, as I said, like a lifting of the veil where you can see fully. For me, it's the true state of being, and that's how I feel.
Yeah, I love that way of describing it, actually. Did you say a tool for illumination? It's so beautiful. And also, I love the lifting of the veil, because I was going to kind of talk about apocalypse and the sort of like the original meaning of apocalypse, which is a kind of a revelation, which is a revealing of the way things truly are. And so I think queer ecology for me is still like the term itself. It still comes from, you know, the realm of sort of like scientific theories and academic thinking. And so I have a relationship to it in the sense that I felt that I was having a certain kind of experience of queer ecology. And then I learned the term and applied it. And So in that sense, like I love the idea of it, of thinking of it as a tool for illumination, because it illuminated the way that I was already orienting myself in the world. I guess I would, if I had to pinpoint like a specific time, I experienced a very strange period about 10 years ago where I'd lost somebody, and somebody who was very special to me and my family had died. And this was a person who was not a parent and who was very unconditionally loving and accepting of me exactly as I was before I was really sort of fully embracing my own queerness. And around the same time, I think in retrospect, I see now that having this very personal grief kind of opened me to the grief of like living in a dying world and living in a, I think I had very skillfully avoided, very skillfully avoided the reality, like the apocalypse that needed to happen, which is to understand that there, you know, we're on a pretty frightening trajectory as a planet and as a species. And I think those things kind of happened to me at the same time. So kind of losing this person, then sort of like being rejected by my own family on the basis of my sexual identity, like all of a sudden queerness and ecology and like a way of thinking about the world, like we're really coming together through grief and through the sort of depths that grief opened. And I find the terminology very useful, sort of as long as it doesn't stay in the realm of like process and academic gatekeeping. And when I can see it applied in the world and in really practical ways, yeah, then I feel like I can live into it.
Yeah, maybe I could jump in. I mean, I love the concept of queer ecology because a bit like degrowth, it's quite a challenging concept that kind of forces you to take notice, basically. But my whole question for both of you is whether queer ecology is best understood not as a philosophy or a politics. Is it an aesthetic? Is it a mode of being in and to the world, which doesn't have anything particularly to say about, you know, big political issues, although it may do? I think that might be quite interesting. But then particularly for both of you to look at that, is it an aesthetic, a mode of being in the world? And then, Oana, I was interested in your connection with grief and particularly the importance of something that we discussed on the pod in the past, is the importance of embracing vulnerability and embracing radical pluralism. We don't know how things are going to work out. And rather than try and either through science or technology or a hard ideology try and fix what the outcome would be. So I don't know whether you want to say something a little bit more about the importance of vulnerability in the concept of queer ecology, and particularly how there's a kind of a radical dependence that both of you are touching upon, which goes against the kind of modern scientific capitalist liberal view, which is all about control, all about dominating and being independent. I mean, that's almost a conception of freedom in our contemporary world, is how independent you can be from others, particularly by accumulating wealth or power. So maybe that concept of grief and vulnerability for you, Oana. And then Niamh, particularly because three of us on the call are Irish, and Oana has a great affection for the island. I couldn't help but thinking when I was listening to you of the Fifth Province, you know, this realm of creativity and imagination in Irish history and mythology, and whether you explicitly identify that in terms of, you know, locating queer ecology in Ireland, you know, sounds a bit too fixed, but whether this idea of the Fifth Province plays any part in your own thinking and work. But perhaps, Oana, if you'd like to begin with that, you know, reflection on grief, vulnerability, dependence, perhaps.
Just to maybe keep myself grounded, I'll share kind of like a definition that I've come across as far as, you know, whether queer ecology is a mode or an aesthetic. The sort of running current working definition is something like it's a theory that aims to bring together queer theory and ecology to shift paradigms away from binary, rigid, and heteronormative ways of understanding nature towards interdependency and fluidity. And so I think that that definition really kind of addresses some of the points that you raised about the pluralism and about the need for dependence and interdependence and that way of being vulnerable in the world. Yeah, I think the part about grief and vulnerability, you know, it's very difficult to be vulnerable when you are at threat and when it's difficult to find a sense of safety. And I think that there are so many things about the way the world is structured. Currently, I know in Ireland, definitely where during this time that I spent in the US, you know, everything from healthcare to housing to the energy crisis. So it's not immediately clear how all of these things are connected, you know, how queer ecology and the housing crisis or the energy crisis are connected. But of course they are. If we really take seriously the idea that human beings are also part of nature, you know, and not something separate, then the ways that we relate to each other, the ways that we relate to ourselves, the ways that we relate to a sense of mystery or sacredness in our lives, like all those things are part of the same system as nature, are part of the same cycles. So I think vulnerability becomes really becomes endangered in a system where our nervous systems are always at threat. We can even kind of lose the capacity for being vulnerable. And, you know, for me, I think that moment where I had this really personal grief that kind of opened me to the grief that was already always there in the world, like just being a human alive today, is a cause for grief. I don't know if you're familiar with the writer and musician, and I don't know what else he would call himself, the teacher, Stephen Jenkinson, but like he would say, if every age is governed by a kind of, not governed, but is like held by a particular mode, like a particular emotion, like we are definitely in the age of grief. We are facing planetary collapse. We are facing, you know, the direct outcomes of human behavior. Not everybody, some humans. So I think the ability to be vulnerable is incredibly political because it's the ability to look directly at where we are and to stop trying to come up with, the simplest, most efficient, most resource-hungry solution for every problem that we have. But that requires us to really be able to sit in the kind of, in the pain of the uncertainty of the moment. Like Neve was saying, like, we really don't know where things are going. I think anybody that says, you know, it's definitely the end for us, I don't believe that certainty. And anybody that is in denial about that, I don't believe in that certainty either. So the hardest thing is just to be vulnerable in this like apocalypse, basically, this space where things are being revealed. So yeah, vulnerability is a skill as well. You know, like that's kind of what we do together. And I know Linda is quite involved in Active Hope work and the work that we connect. And like those kinds of facilitating spaces, the kinds of spaces that you have to go to need when you're like working creatively and building community and facilitating, like that vulnerable space is, I think, really needed.
Just to add to that, really, it's funny and maybe indicative of, you know, myself as an Irish person, that I really didn't have the language for the thing I was searching for. Actually, I'm very blessed to meet Oana. This is just going to be a tiny little segue where I give a lot of love to Oana. When Oana spoke about grief for the first time, again, it was like this light bulb moment, you know. I'm very a practically minded person, and I kind of learn by like doing and experiencing and speaking to people, actually. Well, you know, a lot of people do, but I wouldn't be very academic. A lot of my practice comes from working with others. That's why I'm a collaborative artist and not a solo one. But remember when Ioana spoke about Grishbeck, a lot of things clicked for me, you know? Like, I have, so my collaborative arts practice is called Spooky Pure. And a lot of that is, I realized, is grief work. And it's grief for being brought up in a kind of, in nationalist ideologies, in capitalist ideologies, and grief for this separation, this kind of hurt for all that we have lost, you know, and kind of all that you lose in the building of a nation and the building of wealth. So yeah, I would like to kind of thank Ioana for that in many ways, but I think it's the same really. With there is a lot of hope in queer ecology, you know, because there is this like ideologies of capitalism, ideologies of colonialism again, would tell us that we are separate, you know, we're separate and invulnerable, and being of nature actually makes us vulnerable. There's also a contradiction in the now, you know, with living at what we think of as the end, which is probably just a continuation, or a, you know, what we're doing now is not sustainable, you know. So there's a lot in green politics now, or there's a certain, well, maybe with the Green Party in Ireland, about this whole thing of sustainability and greenwashing, which, yeah, it's not original thought. This is not maybe originally coming from me, but like there's a lot of pushback in that, being like, well, it's not sustainable actually. And there's this contradiction, like, that in the past, the idea was you separate yourself from nature to become invulnerable from nature. But now there's this idea that no, we can sort of continue on sustaining ourselves. And, you know, nature's not vulnerable. Like, nature's fine. Nature will be fine. And it's like, you know, people who would argue against climate change. So you can maybe cast some doubts around climate change, but you cannot deny that there's hardly any insects. Where are all the insects gone, you know? So I would also echo the embrace of vulnerability. Like, we are of nature. Nature is vulnerable, and so are we. And like any ecosystem, you know, ecosystems in nature survive from a lot of codependence. You know, there's that famous one about like wolves being introduced to Canada and change the course of a river. That's a very famous story. There's so many examples of that, you know. If you take away the insects, if you like, we don't have plants, we don't have oxygen, we don't have food, we don't have shelter, we don't have all of these things. I think at this stage it's banging on, but
I just like reminded the issue, sorry to cut across you, of the fifth province, you know, the particular Irish experience perhaps as a location of queer ecology, and whether it's in your own work, for example, given, you know, it is kind of a prominent aspect of Irish mythology and so, you know, liminal thinking. And so, yeah, whether that is how queer ecology lands or can be tethered in an Irish context, or whether it is reflected or resonates with you, your understanding of queer ecology, or indeed in your work.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I suppose like, there is so much myth connected to land. You know, there's the physical land, and then there is how the land and nature exists on the human plane, and then the supernatural nature of like flowers, plants, animals, and the land itself, you know, in mythology, like mountains being and islands being formed by the bodies of giants, mountains being built by the Kailuk, for example, like whole plains being cleared by goddesses like Taltin and stuff. Yeah, it absolutely resonates with me. And then things like, you know, rowan trees, ash trees, like all knowledge coming from hazelnuts, and then the salmon of knowledge eating the hazelnuts, and then that being delivered finally onto Fionn McCool. It definitely figures in my psyche. So, I mean, I went to a Gaelic school. So before we did histories, we did mythologies, you know, and that was very kind of hero based, though, which is interesting. You know, I have a lot of feelings around kind of the nationalism that was instilled within me in Irish schools. And I think a lot of what I do in art now as an adult is still kind of pushing back against that.
Can I ask you a question, Niamh? Because you just brought up exactly the thing that I wanted to ask you about this particular thing. Because, yeah, so Niamh and I have a supernatural connection sometimes. I feel like we don't talk for months, and then I'm thinking about a question I have in my head from her, and I get a message, a text message, like, hey, just thinking about you, how you doing? So I just wanted to ask, because this is something that is so resonant for me about kind of my experience with connection to folklore in Romania. And we talked about this a little bit in our conversation before around how I think part of like what's queer to me about these earth connected, these earthbound and sort of like spirit, both earth and spirit bound spaces. Like, I don't know if there's something in Romanian kind of like the fifth province, but is that they're completely wild. Like they're wild and they're devoid of the kind of order that nationalism places on them, right? So, you know, I was very interested in like all the Celtic Twilight stuff when I was first studying Irish poetry. And then I was looking for traces of that kind of stuff in Romanian mythology. And I was nervous about going back to those spaces because they always seem so heteronormative. You know, it's always about like marriage and procreation and, you know, whose goat is being sold for, you know, as a dowry and that kind of like all those songs are about that kind of stuff. And then when I really dug in, I realized actually those stories are like about people changing genders, about people cross-dressing, about all kinds of, you know, like they're completely queer. But I'm very interested in what you've just said about like the nationalism and how those stories get flattened into this and into this you know, not just watered down version, but completely like anemic version of themselves, like where they don't have the power that they have anymore because they're being used for another purpose, which is to, you know, sort of like a nationalistic, to build a nationalistic identity. And so, yeah, I wanted to maybe nudge you a little further on that topic because I'm really interested in it myself.
Yeah, so I think with a lot of the hero tales, you know, I mean, there's a great focus on violence and that, even though there are a lot of like, there's a lot of queerness in those tales, you know, or is at least it's very, very open for playing with that, you know. But for me, the site that I was always most interested in was folk tales of fairies and folk tales of land and, you know, things like the fear and sort of what's the word? Or the reverence, the fear and reverence people would have for trees or sites. Like, well, obviously there's the hawthorn and all of the folklore that is surrounded in that, you know, it could be dangerous or helpful, just as, you know, the shiwar, the dini shiwar. Also the role of wells and bodies of water, you know, like, so all of the kind of folk vernacular around that and how present the land and nature is in that for me is very much ties into queer ecologies, you know, and how there can be like serious cause and effect. You catch the wrong fish, you do the wrong thing, there's going to be consequences for you. So I think, yeah, it is a very fertile ground looking at that. So for me, it's less about the kind of these big heroes, these exceptional heroes, even though they're gay as fuck. Like, For me, it's more for me, the site of the most kind of interest for queer ecologies would be the folklore around land and nature, and even what the nature of the she are. You know, are they, well, there's like a notion that they're like exactly like us, but and they have their own rules and everything like that, but they're just not us. So maybe even thinking of the she in terms of queer ecologies, it's like nature is us. It's not us, but it's exactly like us, or like we're, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I'll just jump in and, you know, listening to you, what strikes me is that there's a lot of similarities with ecofeminism, you know, especially the idea of this creation of the other, you know, the other that's not the the white heterosexual male. And I suppose, you know, so women became other, nature became other, you know, the land was separated from us, I suppose, as the land and the groundwork for capitalism to flourish, really. And then these creations of dualisms that have just become more and more embedded. And, you know, that idea that then that other is unnatural or like not what should be the leading or what is looked up to in our society. So I suppose, do you agree that there's a lot of similarities with ecofeminism and how do you think they weave together?
Yeah, I think one question that I think in some ways is at the heart of both ecofeminism and queer ecology is the question of the feminine. And that is not just to mean, you know, female gender, but the feminine as in feminine qualities. Like what do we identify as feminine qualities? So what is receptive? What is a way of, like, I always think of the difference between a kind of drive towards a goal that seems very, you know, in a kind of aesthetic sense, very like phallic, whereas like building receptivity and sort of building a womb-like space in which something can happen, it's a very different approach. And I think it's not to place either one over the other, but I think at least the four of us can agree that there are some aspects that have become dominant to the detriment of the others. And so really this is about, and I think this is what I'm so drawn to, you know, the kind of the feminism of bell hooks or the ecofeminism of Joanna Macy, is that it's not about raising women to the conditions of men, but about thinking about balance and about thinking about how actually to heal the relationship between the two, and not just two, between like endless combinations of masculine and feminine and everything in between. So I do definitely see a lot of crossover. And I think in the other, another kind of similarity they have are the tensions that can't be resolved. You know, I think not like some ecofeminists are very spiritual and some ecofeminists believe that has no place. You know, it's very much about sort of like driving policy or, so I think as soon as we kind of try to confine each one of these things and to say, as soon as we stop them being dynamic, then a need for something new arises, because I think that's the essence of both of these spaces, is that they're incredibly dynamic. Like I almost feel that queer ecology is redundant, because ecology, the way it was first framed, was already about being dynamic, was already about how things are dynamic. But I almost feel as if, you know, we started to kind of take the word for granted. And so putting the word queer in front of it makes us have to rethink what that means. Like, what does it mean? And I feel in some ways the same about ecofeminism, is that it's a way to, you know, feminism in some spaces wasn't doing enough or was like taking certain things for granted. And so we needed to reframe things. We needed to consider Black feminists and womanists and, you know, all like different, as many different kind of framings. And I think only when we can accept that it's always going to be like that, that both of those terms are always going to be dynamic, then we're kind of getting to what they really are.
I think often the system likes to co-opt our concepts and funnel them back in. So maybe that's why there's a need for constant creation. I just also wanted to ask, how do you see the queer ecology can help us create communities or build communities and relationships, like as the Sabatistas would say, like a world where many worlds fit. So how can it help us create that world where many worlds fit?
For me, queer ecology would be a tool, a liberation tool. You know, we're living at a time where on both sides of the sea to us, we are seeing like the oppression and the out and out violence toward trans people, and also the ongoing violence towards Indigenous communities. And I think it does stem again from this notion of, this narrowed notion of what is a quote unquote natural. I think it's very archaic, and I think it's unrealistic, because we know if you spend any time at all in nature or looking at nature, how, and I say this like so positively, how weird and deviant, you know, nature is deviant. It's to echo back to that definition at the beginning. Nature is deviant, so nothing is deviant, you know. So for me, you know, so much of that sentence or that phrase or that chant of like, it's not natural, you know, it's disordered, is used to separate us and to disempower us and to make us fear each other. That's what it is. It's to make us fear each other. And there is also, I found it like really wonderful that there's been a lot of pushback, even by like botanists and stuff like that, against the term like an invasive species. Like, what is an invasive species if a plant comes? So this is, sorry, I'm shifting from like speaking about like gender to, you know, then things like borders. But like, you know, the borders of nature, there's no borders to nature. If a plant grows somewhere, if it can survive somewhere, then how can you say it's not meant to be there, you know? So for me, there's kind of two concepts in, yeah, queer ecology that can help us like build trust and move away from borders, barriers, and gatekeeping nature. You can't do that. Also, you know, another thing as well is, I must actually try and track it down, and maybe I can put it in the notes where I came across this. People were talking about, how are we going to survive, or how are we going to adapt to the world, or try and help nature or help ecologies survive our continued onslaught. And I'll try and find who said this, but they were saying, you know, you're going to have to become comfortable with living with flies in your home. Why do you hate that? You know, I live with a lot of plants, so every now and again I get, you know, fungus gnat blooms, and that's just the way it is. I get ladybirds, which is, you know, less bad. No, I'm not saying that you open your home to moths and all form of moving beetles, but perhaps you don't freak out as much. Actually, if you know, okay, so you have a moth problem, maybe let the spiders like do their thing in your home. I don't understand, a lot of people would not like to live like that, but you can live like that, is the point. So I guess that is another little rambling response. But I guess for me, yeah, it helps build community, because if you look at how ecologies live and work, we're interdependent on each other. And
what I'm going to say now is a performative contradiction, given how both of you have quite eloquently talked about the violence of borders, of categories, of the disciplining power of time. And that's what we're up against now. We have to do it, rather than to a close. I just wanted to ask you both one last question. But as I was listening to you both, I was hearing, in my own understanding, you know, post, not anti-humanism, but post-humanism of a con-specific sharing of this place, not just the place we're in terms of the, you know, geography, but actually the planet. And also a kind of a real emphasis on freedom and autonomy and liberation. So I don't know whether you both want to just talk about the ways in which you both, from your different perspectives, understand the connection of queer ecology in freeing the imagination and actually being an expression of emancipation in some way. But that's what I'm hearing for you. The nearest, because I'm a professor of politics, the nearest ideology I can come up with, well, not just ecofeminism, is kind of anarchism, a kind of a liberatory, you know, sense of non-state, certainly not nation-state driven, and is that more community? And that's, of course, what anarchism is. And anarchism, enforced, a bit like apocalyptic, that Oana talked about at the beginning, in ancient Greek, it simply means lifting of the veil. Anarchy, it does not mean chaos. I mean, that is a very partial kind of European understanding of the 19th century, usually a man with a cloak, with a bomb that's ticking, that's going to be thrown at an archduke or whatever. But anarchy simply means stateless order. So whether or not that is something you recognize, of that kind of anarchistic liberatory impulse that's really at the heart of both your understandings of queer ecology, or is it that plus something else? Even that is not a container big enough for everything that queer ecology can bring to us.
Yeah, I'll jump in. And I had just written down while Niamh was talking earlier that I was thinking about queer ecology as punk and as, you know, disobedience, but not purely for the sake of disobedience, but, you know, for this kind of, I guess, communal order, I would say, interdependent order. That really resonates. And as somebody who growing up was like much too obedient to be able to be interested in punk, you know, I do think of queerness itself, I guess, as a way of thinking about kind of, they're not even new ways of building community. And I struggle with anything post, because we're never kind of post anything. My field, you know, for the last 10 years has been in theology, and I, you know, we're always in the wake of, we're always in the legacy of the historical moments that we're talking about. So, you know, Ireland is becoming, it's quickly becoming a secular nation, but it doesn't mean that the habits of mind and the habits of relation that were formed over, you know, centuries of colonization and of how that and how famine affected the development of the way that the religion, the way that people think of religion in kind of modern times, like all of those things, we're always living in the wake of them. So what I think the queer ecology, that what that framework can add to our movements, or can give us, can really, I think, enliven our movements, is by reminding us that those boundaries are always temporary, and that our real work is to be in movement and to be dynamic and to be kind of questioning, like anything that we start to get take for granted, then to be questioning. And I think that becomes easier to do, being vulnerable becomes easier to do in community. And so, you know, those, it's like, I don't know which comes first. Like, do we need to strengthen our communities first or meet our individual needs? I think even that, we have to do both all the time. And the other thing that I keep thinking about that I wanted to make sure to bring in is that I think the queerness in general, and also queer and like the queer lens of queer ecology, there's something very like seriously playful about this orientation. So it's playful and disobedient, and but it's serious in doing that. And you know, there are people working in Ireland. So as I was saying, I'm more familiar with the kind of like theology academic world, but there, you know, there's Jacob Erickson is a queer theologian teaching at Trinity College, and who is trying to bring that sense, you know, into a very ordered environment, like bringing that kind of those questions into classrooms at Trinity. And then I don't know if any of you have experienced Isabella Rossellini's Green Porno series, where she does this incredible theatrical performance. There were videos, and then she kind of, you know, took it to different stages, but like enacting the sex lives of insects and sea creatures on stage. And just, I think that playfulness, that energy, that creativity is like one of the real gifts of the queer lens of anything, but particularly with something as serious as ecology.
Can I ask you to talk a bit about jellyfish? You mentioned them before, and it was really interesting. I was primarily a wee bit traumatized remembering my jellyfish sting last year, but hearing you talk about it was fascinating. So could you talk about how jellyfish actually demonstrates or exemplifies queer ecology?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So yeah, anytime I hear somebody, again, you know, putting a very limiting lens on the order, natural order, and what that is, I always think, you know, have you been in the ocean? Have you seen the ocean? And jellyfish, I have a jellyfish tattoo on my hand, and it is kind of like a little talisman to remind me of the nature of things. So there are obviously many kinds of jellyfish. There is the Portuguese man of war, which is not actually one animal, by the way. It is a colony of many kinds of animals. So it is obviously one mass of things, but yeah, it is thousands of organisms in basically interdependence, living together. There's another type of jellyfish who scientists have discovered is potentially immortal, because it can revert to its polyp stage. It can go and, you know, grow to full adulthood and then revert back into its polyp stage. So when a jellyfish what will become a jellyfish is like floating around the ocean as plankton, it eventually, due to some scientific process or some ecological process that I don't know the name of, it basically, there's a time in which it will drop down to the sea and grow on that, grow on a rock. And then the thing that has been growing on the rock will release another, and then that will eventually grow into a jellyfish. But this particular kind of jellyfish can reverse that process. They don't know how or why, but it can do that. And then, of course, there's other wonderful things about a jellyfish, but then it also reminds me of the various types of fish, such as a clownfish, which, depending on whether it is beneficial to it or not, can change its sex from a male to a female. And that is just brilliant and beautiful and wonderful. And we should take heart in that, in knowing that. So yeah, whenever you're feeling kind of oppressed by the limits of the human world, just remember that a jellyfish out there has just decided to Benjamin Button itself into another decade or so of living. So I'm very light on particulars there with names. So, but I do encourage you to, you know, just to read up, to our listeners to read up on themselves and just get inspired. When you're feeling stuck in a rut, just think of a jellyfish.
Yeah, I don't feel so, I'm reframing those 5 hours of pain and think how to think of jellyfish differently now. Yeah, so we are coming to the end. I suppose, yeah, thanks so much, both of you, for joining us. It's been fascinating and brilliant. Yeah, so just to say that ABC's Green Politics is part of the Left Bloc Political Educational Project. And yeah, so this has been Q, and stay tuned for the next episode, which is R. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. Thanks, Lana, Niamh, and John.
Thank you all. So all praise the apocalypse and all praise the jellyfish.
Woo! Yep. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you.